Well, good morning, everybody. Happy Valentine's Day. This is February 14th, and it's Bio 231. You had your first exam last class period, and it's all graded. It's in Blackboard for you to see your scores. But if you want to review your test, please come to office hours, or you look at them in the lab.
Okay, I got to make sure I didn't turn the off button. Okay, we're good.
So, we're a little bit busy this week in lab because you want to look at your lab practicums and your lecture test. Don't know if we have time to do all that, but so see me during my office hours, Tuesday, Thursday, 9:30 to 11:30. You're welcome to do that. And, of course, you all should check your tests because you learn a lot when you look at least for the first test. You see how I word questions, make sure that you're not mismarking your Scantron. Oh, there were a couple people that had a nice organization scheme for their Scantrons. They fixed them so that they could be placed in the three-ring binder with their textbook like this. But that means that they have to do what? Put three holes in the Scantron. And unfortunately, that makes the Scantron invalid. So we have to figure out how we're going to grade it. Probably bring in a new Scantron and just copy your answers over to the new Scantron. And then I'll be able to grade it for you. But I just can't go down question by question. Okay, so the Scantron's no stray marks or any kind of mutilation to it. It can't be read by the Scantron reader. So anybody have any questions about the test or anything like that? They're online for you to look, and then in lab you'll be able to look at the keys and the questions. All right, so we were talking about the skeletal system. Oh, don't forget, a week from today. What's a week from today? It's a holiday, President's Day, so you really get to catch up with everything in lecture and prepare a lot for lab. And that will help you a lot, I'm sure, in the class. All right, so components of the skeletal system. You have bone, of course, but you got two other things. You have cartilage and you have ligaments. And ligaments, remember, they're made of dense, regular connective tissue. But the definition of a ligament, who knows the definition of a ligament? What does it attach? It attaches two things. Bone to bone. It's a bone to bone attachment. Most ligaments, well, all ligaments stabilize the joint, stabilize the two bones that it connects. Some ligaments allow certain kind of motion between two bones, but most ligaments actually immobilize that joint between the two bones that it attaches, thereby stabilizing it. So the figure that we see on the right is a skeleton, and it's got two of the three components. I see bone, that's in this like a beige color, and then it has cartilage. And from histology, you should remember, there are three different kinds of cartilage, and we got three different colors right here. We got hyaline cartilage, elastic cartilage, and fibrocartilage. Which one is the strongest? Yeah, fibrocartilage, because it has a lot of collagen in it. Hyaline cartilage doesn't really have much in the way of collagen. It has collagen, but it's not in a strong fibrous form. It's in a soluble form, and so it acts more like a sponge as opposed to a Kevlar or a steel cable. Okay, so this shows pretty much the whole skeletal system, and I think we're going to start talking about that pretty soon. We did talk about functions of the skeletal system. Some of these are pretty obvious, right? Bones give support. They can bear great weight. Bone just doesn't compress very much. Cartilage is firm but flexible, allows for a certain kind of motion. And it's also used as a precursor to bone. It plays an important role for bone formation in your body. Protection, of course, the skull protects the brain. Rib cage protects the... Like what? What would the rib cage protect? Oh, like the heart and lungs, all of those you want nice and healthy. And vertebral column, of course, protects the spinal cord. And bones are also important for motion because muscles attach to bones. And what is muscle specialized to do? Muscle is specialized for contraction, shorten. And when it shortens, it pulls two bones together. So it moves bones, it moves your skeleton around, at least one kind of muscle does. And I think from histology, the chapter on histology, you should know which kind of muscle is important for moving your skeleton around. Your skeletal muscles are, right? Skeletal muscle. And you should kind of know what it looks like. All right, and then this last two right here, probably you're not aware of unless you've taken a physiology or anatomy class, functions of bone, but it's a very important storage depot for calcium, for phosphate, for inorganic phosphate, and also for fat, which is a reserve of energy in your body. All right, so you probably all knew that calcium was important for bones, but calcium is important for other important functions in your body, and we're going to learn about some of those. Maybe some of you are aware of other important functions for calcium. So maybe I'll just ask, does anybody know where else calcium is important besides your bones in your body? Muscle contraction. That's on the tip of my tongue. Muscle contraction. You need calcium for muscle contraction. So just if you think of that, where do you think it's more important to have calcium? For muscle contraction or for bones? If you had to choose between one of those two areas. Muscle, because without muscle you can't even breathe, right? So that kind of underscores why there is a pathology that develops in all of us if we're lucky enough to live long enough. What's that pathology? It is called osteoporosis. I'm sure all of you have heard of osteoporosis. That's when, as we get older, our bones demineralize, they lose calcium, and they get weak, and they're prone to fracture as a result of that. Maybe I'll try to talk about that maybe at the end of lecture. All right, and an important thing that also makes bones really hard is inorganic phosphate. And you see the chemical formula right here. Sometimes we call that P sub I, standing for inorganic phosphate. But it has this chemical formula right here. It has phosphate with four oxygens and some hydrogens around it, and that forms a complex with calcium that makes it very, very hard. Okay, so bones store important minerals for us as well as energy. And then the last thing right here is that it is a hematopoietic tissue. Did anybody look that up over the weekend or last week after you get done studying the test? What is a hematopoietic tissue? It's a tissue that makes something that has hemoglobin in it, which is a red blood cell. Okay, so red bone marrow is a hematopoietic tissue. It's involved in hemopoiesis, that means making red blood cells. And is that an important process? How would you maybe explain that to somebody? Why is that an important process?
It's very important because red blood cells.
Yeah, without red blood cells, you can't circulate oxygen in your body. And remember, mitochondria need oxygen to make ATP, and you need ATP all over the place. You need 40 kilograms of ATP every single day. And another way of thinking about that is, what's the lifespan of a red blood cell? Or another way of saying that is, how many red blood cells die in your body every second? About 2 million, between 1 and 2 million. So that hematopoietic tissue has to build 1 to 2 million red blood cells every second, otherwise you become anemic. So bone is very important for all kinds of different reasons, not just one reason. And we're going to learn that with many organ systems and or organs in your body. They perform many functions. All right, so this is kind of where we left off before, and that is, we're going to talk about the components, just the anatomy of the skeletal system, and that is cartilage. This is the first one that we see on the slide over here, right? The three kinds of cartilage. One that only has soluble collagen in it and some other compounds. That's hyaline cartilage. That's the weakest kind. We find that on articulating surfaces between bones, right? Sometimes we call it hyaline cartilage. Sometimes we call that articular cartilage because it's formed in articulations. Articular cartilage or hyaline cartilage also makes the intercostal cartilages right here. And hyaline cartilage is not really strong, so it is bendable. It is pretty lightweight. The next strongest kind is elastic cartilage. And where can you see elastic cartilage on here? How about the ear? Right here. Your ear is bendable. Since it has elastic cartilages, if you bend your ear, what's going to happen to it when you let go? It's going to flop right back to its original position, right? Because it has elastic fibers. And then the strongest kind right here is fibrocartilage. And we find that in the pubic symphysis. That's a joint between two of the bones that make up the pelvis, right? And intervertebral discs to protect the vertebral bodies. For those of you that had vertebrae in lab already, that's the major part. That's a massive bony part of a vertebrae. And that's the column that supports your body weight. And we don't want these vertebrae grinding each other down. So there are fibrocartilage discs called intervertebral discs between the vertebral bodies. Okay. Oh, another important place, for elastic cartilage. I'm glad I wrote it down. Not only the ear, but something that gets a good workout every single day, that's the epiglottis. And the epiglottis is right at the junction between an airway and a passageway that takes food to your stomach called the esophagus. And so that epiglottis is very important for making sure that air goes into your lungs. But when you swallow something, food goes not into your lungs, right, which could kill you if that occludes an airway, but then it goes down the esophagus into your stomach. So the esophagus is a trapdoor that's bending back and forth, protecting your airway when you swallow things, most of the time, not every single time. Okay, and that fibrocartilage in these intervertebral discs right here have two parts to it. There's an annulus fibrosus, which is on the exterior. It forms a ring on the exterior. And then there is a jelly-like material on the inside of the disc. So if a disc gets damaged, that jelly-like material can actually squirt out past that annulus fibrosus and impinge upon some nerves that are leaving through the intervertebral foramen. So I'm using some terminology that people learned in lab. If you haven't had lab yet, you will hear that this afternoon. So it's okay if I give you a little foreshadowing of some things that we're going to look at. Okay, so that's cartilage, and you should kind of know what it looks like, the three kinds, like nice hyaline cartilage, elastic cartilage, fibrocartilage, right? That maybe is ringing a nice bell. Elastic cartilage, it's highly branched, thin fibers. Hyaline cartilage is a very just translucent ground substance. And then collagen and fibrocartilage is very dense and arranged in parallel sheets. Okay, so even though these aren't all to scale, that's still a pretty nice picture. Okay, this shows just zoomed in regions of those three kinds of cartilage. Sometimes we classify bones by their shape. That's an important way. So types of bones. The first type of bone is going to be a long bone. And a long bone, like the humerus right here that we have in the forearm, is long because in the left-right dimension, it's a small distance. It's very short. And in the anterior-posterior dimension, it's very short. But in the cranial-caudal dimension, it's what? It's very long. So in one dimension, it's long. In the other two dimensions, it's short. So therefore, we call that a long bone. You can see numerous long bones in the body, in the appendages, right? And even in your digits. And what the heck is a digit? A finger or a toe is a digit. And the digits have long bones in them as well, right? Even though they are really tiny, right? How can you have a long bone that's tiny? If it's tiny, it's even tinier in what? The left-right dimension and the anterior-posterior dimension. So in a relative sense, even though it's a small bone, it's long because one dimension still is very long compared to the other two. All right, so that's a long bone. Then we have some flat bones, like in the sternum right here. And we have some flat bones in the skull. And some of the bones in the skull have even more flat regions than other parts of flat bones in the skull. Like what's one bone that's notorious for having a flat region? Does anybody remember from lab? The temporal bone, as a matter of fact, that part of the temporal bone right there is actually called the squamous region. Right? But all of these bones right here, that most of these bones that make up the cranial vault are flat bones. Okay. Then, in today's lab, we saw an irregular bone, like a vertebrae. It has numerous processes and articulating surfaces poking out of it, and lots of different holes, like the vertebral foramen, maybe transverse foramina. And a much different part of a vertebrae, the vertebral body, which is just a big, huge chunk of bone right here. So that's what we call an irregular bone. And then there's some bones that don't have quite so many processes sticking out of them, right? And they're neither long and they're not really flat. And that's what we call a short bone. So bones of your wrist and your ankle are what we call short bones. A good example would be the talus that actually articulates with your leg. That's the first bone of your ankle right here. That's the talus. All right, so that's some types of bones. So probably you should have one example of each of these different kinds of bones. Okay, but no matter if it's a long bone, or if it's an irregular bone, or a flat bone, or a short bone, we like to use a model in our mind to think of how all bones are structurally put together. And the best bone to appreciate all the characteristics that bones have is a long bone right here. So we're going to take a humerus, which is in your arm, and look at the pieces that make up bone. All right, so here is, do I have it on the list? Yeah, it's all there for you to see. A long bone has two ends. Now, you can't really say that about a short bone or an irregular bone. They have all different kinds of ends, but a long bone has two ends, and an end of a bone is what we call an epiphysis. All right, so here is an epiphysis, and the other end is an epiphysis, but now you got to learn or use some terminology that you learned previously. What do we call some body region that is close to some attachment point in your body as opposed to farther away? Is proximal, and the more distant part of the bone is the distal, right? And so you have a proximal epiphysis and a distal epiphysis right here. Those are both epiphyses. And then this region right here is not an epiphysis. This is the shaft of a bone, but the proper terminology is diaphysis. So make sure you know how to pronounce those words, epiphysis and diaphysis, because that will help you spell them, because this is an important item for a practical exam, right? Which you'll have to know how to spell. Okay, so you got the two epiphyses and the one diaphysis right here surrounding the whole bone, the complete bone. If we zoom into this region right here and peel it back a little bit, is the periosteum. So anytime you hear osteo or osteum, you should think of bone. And periosteum is a membrane that completely surrounds the bone, and it contains special cells that we'll talk about in just a second. So not only is there a membrane surrounding the exterior of every bone, but there is a membrane that lines every internal space inside of a bone. And you can see that here is one big large space inside this long bone, and here are a bunch of little spaces, and there is a membrane that lines each of these little cavities and this large cavity right there, and that is called the endosteum. All right, and again, you know that belongs to bone because of that suffix, or the second part of this word is what? Osteo, osteum right there. It has different kinds of cells in it. It's going to make a difference in how this bone grows. So here is the periosteum, right? And I can't really see the, oh, maybe you can see the endosteum right here. It looks like there's a little bit different color right in this region right there. That would be the endosteum. Okay. All right. So what can you tell me about this bone? Is it alive? Absolutely. Thank goodness. I'm glad you said yes, because you're alive, right? Things inside your body are alive, including bones, right? They're loaded with living cells. And maybe, could you remember the name of a cell on the practicum that you had to know? Osteocyte. So this bone right here is not like that concrete pillar in this building, because the bones inside your body are living tissues filled with living cells. And those cells rebuild all of your bones every 5 years. Right? So every 5 years you have a completely new skeleton. Your bone is broken down and then is built back up in the way that you use your body to make your skeleton strong and respond to its particular use. All right, so the bone is a living organ. And a lot of times, organs are different on the superficial part of an organ compared to the deep part of an organ. So when I say superficial, what do I mean? The outer part, right on the surface. And the deep part is some interior region of an organ. All right. But there's better terminology that we can use to talk about a superficial region on an organ compared to a deep region. When we're talking about a superficial region, we call it the cortex. So a bone is an organ. So here is the cortex of a bone right here. And the cortex of a bone is made out of compact bone or solid bone. Just like the adrenal gland has a cortex. The kidney has a cortex. That's a superficial layer. But organs sometimes have a medulla as well. That's the deep part of an organ, like the adrenal cortex, adrenal medulla and renal medulla. These are the deep parts of these various organs. And the deep part of the bone right here, where the cursor is moving over, this is the medulla of a bone. And you can see the bone takes on a different shape. It looks like It looks like a sponge. And as a matter of fact, we can call it a sponge. But since it's in the medulla, what else could you call it? You could call it medullary bone, right? So Spongy bone, medullary bone mean the same thing, and even it has another name called cancellous bone. Cancellous bone, all these little bony plates right here, is all spongy bone, medullary bone. And it's lined with the endosteum, and it has marrow in all of these different spaces right here. The other place where we have marrow is in this big cavity. Now, where is this cavity located? In the cortex or medulla of the bone? It's a medulla. So we call that the medullary cavity. And it's lined with the endosteum as well. All right, and you can have, it's filled with bone marrow. It's hollowed out because that gives a tubular structure to bone, which makes it very resistant to compression. And no space in your body is wasted. It's filled either with yellow bone marrow that we see right here, which is lipid or adipose tissue. And in very young people, it is loaded with the hematopoietic tissue, which does what? It makes red blood cells. So most of the long bones in our bodies, since we're older, is made up of yellow bone marrow, but in young people, it's made up of red bone marrow, which is the hematopoietic tissue. We haven't lost all of the hematopoietic tissue. It's located in our hips and our sternum and vertebrae to some degree. Okay, so we still have a lot of hematopoietic tissue in our body. So remember, there's two kinds of bone marrow. All right, so here is cortical bone. What's another name for cortical bone? Compact. It's solid. It doesn't have these little bony plates. Ooh, let's see. Do I have a picture of bony plates anywhere? Ah, this is a pretty good region. All right, see all these little bony plates? These sometimes are what we call trabeculae. So trabeculae make spongy bone, or cancellous bone, or medullary bone. It's just not quite as solid. What do you think the advantage is to having spongy bone as opposed to cortical bone? It's a lot lighter. It takes a lot less energy, right, to move bones around when they're lighter. And you can imagine, what kind of animals do you think have very light bones, have very little cortical bone right here? At birds, right, because they can't afford to move something really heavy around for flight. All right, so let's go back. I'm sorry, I might have to, oh, this is good right here. All right, so here we have the periosteum. Here is a nutrient blood vessel bringing nutrients to bone because it needs oxygen and nutrients. Here is a little foramen where a blood vessel enters a bone, so that sometimes we call that a nutrient foramen. And it perforates the periosteum, and you can see a bunch of connective tissue fibers that help connect the periosteum to this cortical surface on the bone. We call these perforating fibers or Sharpie's fibers sometimes. Okay, now when we look at compact bone right here, oh, I should have asked you, what kind of bone is this right here? Oh, it says, that's not such a hard question, is it? Compact bone, right, as opposed to spongy bone. And then what do we got right here? What is this inner lining? Endosteum. Oh, that was a good quiz question because it wasn't labeled on this figure. Good, so there's the endosteum, here's the periosteum. Now, does this remind you of anything you looked at underneath a microscope? Yeah, sure does, right? You see, like tree rings, rings inside rings inside rings inside rings, and these are what we call lamellae. All of these are lamellae. These lamellae right here are what we call concentric lamellae. Your book is not making such a big deal of that. Did I make a big deal on my slide right here? Concentric lamellae. Good, it's in your notes. All right, so from previous editions, I like to maintain that nomenclature. These are concentric lamellae. They outline the structural and functional unit of compact bone. All right, so I could ask you structural and functional unit in a lot of things, like what's the structural and functional unit of life? You're going to think of the cell. Complicated thing, right? You got to know all the organelles and that kind of thing. All right, but if you just say that, it has a lot of meaning for you. So the structural and functional unit of compact bone is this structure, all of these concentric lamellae circling each other, and that's called an osteon. And where's that term osteo come from again? Bone. Okay, so this is an osteon. These are concentric lamellae, and this diagram is so-so because actually it's missing something on the outside that's wrapping around all of these osteons right here, and that is another lamella. There are other layers that surround the whole bone, and that's what we call circumferential lamellae. And that's still in your book. So circumferential lamellae actually go around the complete bone. Okay, inside an osteon, there is a tunnel, right? And we call that Haversian canal. So let's see if we have a Haversian, Haversian canal. Ah, here we go. Okay, so here's just a wedge taken out of one osteon. Here is the Haversian canal, and you can see there's an artery and a vein. So bone is highly vascular, and there's also a nerve in there. And because it's highly vascular, when a bone is fractured, what's one bad thing that can happen? Hemorrhage, right? And as a matter of fact, if it's a big bone and a terrible fracture, you can actually die as a result of hemorrhage. But there's always a trade-off. What's the upside to having bone that's highly vascular? That it will repair itself very nicely, right, in a very short period of time, as opposed to tendons, ligaments, and cartilage. Just doesn't repair itself because it's avascular, or relatively avascular. All right, and these blood vessels are supplying oxygen and nutrients to these cells. See if I can get the cursor working. These cells right here, so here is an osteocyte, and it's in a little bubble within the bone matrix that we call a lacunae. All right, so here is a lacunae. And there's the little nucleus of this osteocyte. And it's just maintaining the health of this bone right here. And lacunae are connected to each other via these little tiny processes sticking off of the main body of the cell. And we call these canaliculi. So oxygen and material can diffuse into this cell, and then into this one, and then into this one very nicely because of these canaliculi. Things cannot diffuse through compact bone like the solid bone right here because it would be like hard as a table, right? It's got to move through some kind of fluid or a gas atmosphere for diffusion. So you see canaliculi, osteocytes, and lacunae. Okay, and this would be like 1/4 of an osteon. But here is the inner lamellae, then here are some middle lamellae, and then here is an outer lamella as well. Okay, that make up an osteon. Okay, let's look at this picture right here. Okay, so here is the Haversian canal. This structure that I'm circling right here is the osteon, or sometimes we call that the Haversian system. So this is what the structural and functional unit of compact bone. So you got to know some things like this Haversian canal, the canaliculi, osteocytes and lacunae, and these lamellae right here. There are also, besides these canals that travel in a cranial caudal direction, there are some canals that run in a transverse direction. Let me show you what those look like. Hopefully they're on this slide right here. Oh, like right through here. Here's a transverse one. So these sometimes are what we call perforating canals or transverse canals, right, that carry blood from one osteon to the other, its neighbors that are anterior, posterior, or right and left compared to the Haversian system. So that's a perforating canal. Okay. All right, so what is the structural and functional unit of compact bone called? Osteon, right? And so you should know those different layers. The perforating canals sometimes are called Volkmann's canals. The cells are osteocytes, right? And just be aware of all these little components that make up an osteon. And another name for osteon is Haversian system that makes up compact bone. Okay, what did I want to show you? I wanted to show you something about things that make up bone. Okay, the chemical composition of bone. So let's talk about this area right here. There are two main components in bone. There's an organic component and an inorganic component to bone. The organic components are the living parts. It's cellular. All right, and you learned of one kind of cell. What was the one kind of cell that you learned about? The osteocyte, that's an organic part of bone. An osteocyte maintains mature bone, bone that's all built up. But you have two other kinds of cells in your body. There is a bone called there's a cell called an osteoblast. It builds bone up when bone is growing. But remember, what about your bones? What are they doing all the time? They're growing all the time, right? They're remodeling themselves depending on how you use your body. So for instance, let's make an analogy with muscle. If I walk around with a light weight all day long in my hand, and I flex my elbow doing what we call a curl sometimes, what's going to happen to my biceps and brachialis and brachioradialis? What's going to happen to that? It's going to get bigger and stronger. It's going to respond to that stress. Okay? But not only do those muscles get bigger, those muscles are attached to various bones, like my humerus and ulna and radius. So what's going to happen to my humerus? It's going to get bigger and stronger as well. Okay? Because bone is being remodeled all the time. And the osteoblasts are going to be responsible for that activity. So bone, right, what you're born with are not the bones that you have. As a matter of fact, as of 5 years ago, you have a complete new skeleton rebuilt in the way that you use your body. So when you exercise your body, what does that do to your bones? It makes them bigger and stronger. And what is this pathology? It's a really strange pathology. Because for the following reason. There's a flu going around that's really nasty. People can't come to school or work or whatever. But are all of us going to come down with that flu? No, some of us just have better immunity to that particular strain. Or better yet, what did some of us do? Got a vaccine, got a flu shot. And that's one of the questions. I should have put that on the board. Do you have immunity is what I should have put on the board. Okay, as you walked in class. And that's a really important concept. And if you say no, then kind of I say, duh. Because having the flu sometimes is a real drag. It can really knock you out. As a matter of fact, a lot of people die of the flu, right? So immunizations protect you from infection, right? What are some other things that you all should be concerned about besides the flu vaccine? There's something as you get into a clinical practice, hepatitis vaccines, right? You're going to have to hepatitis vaccines, make sure those are all current. And if you're a teacher or working in healthcare, you also need to, not a vaccine, but a tuberculosis test to make sure you're not a carrier for tuberculosis, right? But vaccines can do a lot for protecting you from some really fatal diseases as well as some that might really inconvenience you a lot later on. So make sure you get your immunizations. The nice thing about immunizations is not only does it protect you, but who else does it protect? It protects your family, right? So that you're not a carrier. You don't bring flu into your own house or whatever. So that's really important if you have young kids or grandparents, right? If you see your grandparents, because I'd really hate to knock my grandparents off just because I didn't get a flu shot, right? So, and that can happen. All right. So the strange disease process I'm thinking about, as opposed to many others, right? Many other processes doesn't affect the whole population, but osteoporosis can. If we're lucky enough to live long enough, we're all going to deal with the effects of osteoporosis, which is demineralization of our bones so that they're prone to fracture. And one gender especially more than the other. What gender is especially more affected than the other? Women, and that's because typically they have smaller, more dainty bones. Men get osteoporosis, but because their bones typically are bigger and stronger to start out with, they can afford to lose more bone before they become fragile. All right, so how can a woman protect themselves from osteoporosis? Exercise, right? Make your bones strong, especially before menopause, and also diet, right? You have to have calcium in your diet, vitamin D, so that you can absorb and use that calcium to make strong bones if you exercise them. And how can you make a bone bigger and stronger? Just by exercising, right? Just by exercising skeletal muscles that pull on these bones. So osteoporosis is a strange condition because it will affect everybody, which is so atypical compared to most disease kind of processes. All right, so let's look at some of the organic and inorganic components that make bone strong. We got these cells, osteoblasts build bone, all right, but if you don't use a bone, guess what's going to happen to it? It's going to get thinner and weaker, and you have cells that will take advantage of that, and they're called osteoclasts. All right, and before you have osteoclasts and osteoblasts, there's a progenitor cell, which is like a stem cell, right? We call it an osteoprogenitor cell. And these populate the periosteum and endosteum right here. And the cells in the periosteum usually are osteoblasts. These are important for making a bone grow in diameter. But you don't want to have a solid bone because it'd be way too heavy and then you wouldn't have a cavity right here. So in the endosteum, we have osteoclasts that then degrade the bone down on the inside to make this cavity and all of those trabecular plates that we saw in spongy bone. All right, so here is probably the most important concept I think that you can ever take away from an anatomy class and even a physiology class. It's actually more a physiologic concept than an anatomical concept, though we do talk about it, and that is, what's the activity between an osteoblast and an osteoclast right here? Are they doing the same thing? What are they doing? What's the one word that you could describe the activity in osteoclast and osteoblast? Dad, they're working in opposition to each other. One is building up and the other is breaking down. We call that antagonism. And that's a very, very important concept, because what happens if the activity of an osteoblast is a lot faster than an osteoclast? Your bone builds up too fast. And that's a problem for some people. Or if the osteoclast activity is too fast, then you start to lose bone. So in order to have a healthy body, what do you have to have between the activity between osteoblasts and osteoclasts? A balance between them, right? So there are many systems in your body that's based on antagonism that provide balance to your body and actually precise control. I'll mention this a number of times. So your bones have the exact proper shape because there is balance between osteoblasts and osteoclasts. And as we get older, unfortunately, which one of these activities gets a little bit stronger? The osteoclast. Our bodies lose a little bit of balance unless we do what?
Exercise
and diet, which is what my grandparents told me years and years and years ago. They didn't know a thing about osteoblasts and osteoclasts, but all right, now it sort of makes sense. Okay, the other organic component is a fiber. And you're familiar with this fiber, and it's collagen. And why should it not be a surprise that we have collagen in bone? Because what kind of tissue is bone? Yeah, it's a connective tissue, right, with a matrix, and we're familiar with collagen in bone. Collagen gives bone flexibility and tensile strength. What does that mean, tensile strength? It means stretching. It resists stretching because it's like a steel cable. You can't stretch a steel cable or a Kevlar cable. So a bone can't be pulled apart very easily because it has collagen. Okay, and it also because of, one of the next slides right here. Okay, it has within the lamellae, Let me close this down. Here's my cursor. Next slide. Right here. Okay, these blue lines right here are collagen fibers. And you see them right between the lamellae, right? So here's the deepest lamellae, here's the middle, here's an external lamellae. And what can you tell me about the orientation of these collagen fibers from one lamellae to the next? They run opposite to each other, right? And so if you ever look at the inside of a tire, we call these belts. In order to give structure to something that's laminar in nature, we align the grains of the material in different directions, and that gives a lot of strength to that material, like plywood, for instance, tires that you have on your car. Bone is made up of that same kind of motif, right? And so because of the different orientation of collagen in different layers, that resists twisting of the bone. So the bone can't twist, and because these run longitudinal to the bone from cranial to caudal direction, it resists stretching of a bone. So it resists tension, which is stretching, and torsion, which is twisting. That's the organic part. And what's the organic fiber in bone? It is? What's the organic fiber in bone that resists twisting and stretching? That's collagen. Okay. But not only is bone important because it doesn't stretch and it doesn't twist because of the collagen, it also doesn't compress. And that's the next part of bone that we're really interested in. And that is the inorganic component of bone. So bone is really important because it can sustain a lot of weight. It can support the weight of the human body. And that's because of the inorganic component of the matrix. And it's made out of mineral salts called hydroxyapatites. Two components of hydroxyapatite is calcium and inorganic phosphate. It gets deposited in the matrix. And it forms these complexes of calcium phosphate that we call hydroxyapatite in this form right here. Now, On a test, you don't have to remember hydroxyapatite or this chemical equation, but you should just be aware that what? Calcium, which is symbolized with this Ca, and inorganic phosphate, which is PO4, right, makes up the strength of bone. But what does it do? Does it resist tension? Does it resist twisting? Or does it resist compression? It resists compression in particular. And those of you that are mechanically inclined at all and know something about cement, cement acts like the calcium phosphate in our bones. Cement by itself is really good for resisting compression, but as soon as you start to twist concrete, guess what happens to it? It fractures, it crumbles. As soon as you start to stretch concrete, guess what it does? It fractures and crumbles. So what do they put in concrete so that it can resist compression as well as stretching and twisting? They put like rebar, they put like iron fibers or other kinds of fibers in concrete so that it acts more like our bones, which is kind of fascinating. It's actually kind of modeled after our bones. Okay, which is why freeways during an earthquake sometimes, if they don't have the columns built correctly, they're perfect, right? They can resist a lot of compression because the concrete is strong, but as soon as it starts to stretch or twist, oh, they just crumble to nothing, right? Unless they're built properly. Okay, so in bone, you got the organic components. Make sure you know what they are and what they are in bone to do. Why are they in bone? And the inorganic components, and why are they in bone? All right, so there is just a nice list. And be familiar with this picture because it shows you the organic component right here and then the inorganic calcium phosphate or the hydroxyapatite matrix that resists compression. Okay, so that's something about bone. All right, so here's a good recapitulation. What components of a bone resist torsion? So what you should be thinking of, what are the two main components of bone? You got organic and inorganic. What resists torsion, which is what? Twisting. It's the organic, right? And what's the organic? Is a cell going to do that or a fiber? A fiber, and the name of that fiber is? Collagen. Good. What about compression? What component? Inorganic, and that's going to be the calcium phosphate or hydroxyapatite resists compression. Okay, and what about tension, which is? Stretching. What resists stretching? Again, it's organic and it's the collagen fiber. And you need both of those to have healthy bone. And unfortunately, some people develop pathologies where they have not enough collagen, so they make bones that can resist compression, but as soon as they stretch or twist them, they fracture. Or during osteoporosis, bones they compress too easily because they're brittle. Okay, so bones have to have all of that activity. Okay, so let's talk about bone formation and growth. So just like there are two components, two major components that make bone, there are two major ways that bones are built. One is called intramembranous ossification, and the second is endochondrial ossification. And the term ossification just means bone formation. Yeah, bone formation, if you want to say bone growth, that's okay with me. All right, so intramembranous ossification, let me tell you this. Before you have a bone in your body, you have some kind of precursor model of what the structure of that bone should look like when it forms and where it should form. And that little model, precursor, sometimes is a membrane, and sometimes it's made out of cartilage. And so that's the two kinds of ossification processes. If it's intramembranous ossification, then it's going to be a flat bone, right? Because a membrane is flat. And if it's a long bone or irregular bone, it's going to develop from a model of cartilage, which we call endochondrial ossification. Because what does chondro or chondrial mean? Cartilage, right? So there's going to be a cartilage model of where bone is going to develop. Okay. So most bones of the skull develop by intramembranous ossification because most of those bones are flat bones. So do I have any kind of slide that shows that? I'm not really sure. Not really good for intramembranous ossification. Okay, oops, sorry. Let me get my cursor back over here. All right, so within that membrane, then there are cells that differentiate. They become osteoblasts. And what's the job of an osteoblast? B is to build, right? Build bone. and it builds a bone matrix within the membrane. All right, and then the osteoblasts become osteocytes after they're completely surrounded by bone. All right, so all the, at birth, bones are not completely formed. That's a really good thing for parturition, so that a fetus can actually squish through the birth canal. That's important, right? Especially the head. And remember, there are non-ossified portions of the bones of the head that we call fontanelles or soft spots. And we have really good models in lab of that. And I suppose, okay, here's a fetus. All right, so here is a suture, all right, that, which is a membrane, but there's some parts of the fetal skull, like right here and right here, and then some right on the mid-sagittal line, which are broad areas of that fibrous membrane that we call fontanelles. So the anterior fontanelle would be right about here, the posterior fontanelle would be here, mastoidal is here, and sphenoidal is right here. So there are four fontanelles. And in lab I mentioned, how long do these fontanelles exist in a newborn? Up to 2 years. So it's a really long time. So not only because it's a membrane is it susceptible to puncture, but it's also susceptible to what? Any kind of torsion or vibration or shaking or whatever could damage the underlying neurologic tissue, like nerves entering or leaving the brain. All right, so you should certainly be aware of that. And then just kind of a fun sidelight, there's a breed of dogs that have fontanelles their whole life. Does anybody know what kind of dog? Maybe you breed these dogs at home. And I always like to have them because they're really cute, but I also have Dobermans, and then I thought, gee whiz, probably not a good idea to have Dobermans with dogs that have fontanelles their whole life. But a Chihuahua has fontanelles their whole life. Okay, so you got to kind of be careful with Chihuahuas. You shouldn't be as rough with them as you can a Doberman, for instance. Okay. All right, so fontanelles. It says right here, up to 24 months, exactly. But why are they there? They're to allow for movement, okay, because the brain is going to grow and the skull has to expand relatively rapidly. And if it was a hard case, then the brain couldn't expand as rapidly as need be, and also for parturition, so that there can be deformation of the cranium, right, just to get through the birth canal. So the head squishes and then goes back to its normal shape. All right, so that's for bones of the cranium. The only exception to that is a bone that makes up the pectoral girdle, and that's the clavicle. Okay, what's the common name for the clavicle? Collarbone, thank you, I forgot. It's the collarbone. Okay, the collarbone. That's a kind of a funny bone because it looks like a long bone, but it's made from intramembranous ossification. All other bones are made out of cartilage first, and so we call that endochondrial ossification. Okay, like the femur and the tibia and the humerus right here. Okay, and the two bones in the forearm. Okay, so a model is made out of hyaline cartilage first. All right, and then some osteoblasts enter a couple areas and they start to deposit bone. So let's look at this process just a little bit. Oops, let me click over here. Okay. So here is a model of a long bone. It could be any long bone that you're interested in. Okay. And this right here, right on, what do we call this part of a long bone? That's a diaphysis. So the diaphysis starts to ossify first, right? And especially on the outside, and a little nucleus on the inside right here. This on the outside sometimes is what we call the bone collar, right? So it forms a ring around the bone. And then there's an ossification center right here in the middle. And then it develops, right, as it moves up toward the epiphyses. And at this time, we have degradation of the cartilage matrix, and then we even have some osteoclasts start to break bone down in the medullary cavity. So this is what we call the primary ossification center that makes up the diaphysis. And then, later on in life, we get a secondary ossification center in the epiphyses, both epiphyses, and notice they have their own nutrient foramina right here. Here you can see a nicely formed bone collar. And then bone starts to develop in the epiphyses, and it expands to eventually where you get a nice line right here. But think in three dimensions. Is this really just a line running through the bone? It actually is a what? It's like a cap. It's a three-dimensional cap that goes all the way, covers the whole surface right here. So this is what we call the epiphyseal plate or growth plate. And it's an ossification center. So this is how a bone grows in length from the epiphyseal plates. And how a bone grows in diameter is from osteoblasts in the periosteum right here. So there's two ways a bone grows, in length at the epiphyseal plates as well as in diameter from osteoblasts in the periosteum. And then what's responsible for making this medullary cavity right here? You have a membrane which is called the endosteum, but the endosteum has special cells that break bone down. What are those cells called? Osteoclasts, right? So those are the two ways that you should be aware that bone grows. All right, so the primary ossification center makes that bone collar, and the osteoclast makes spongy bone and the medullary cavity, which is the trabeculated bone or cancellous bone or spongy bone deep inside. All right, then the secondary ossification centers are in the epiphyses. All right, and then once you have spongy bone and compact bone in the epiphyses, until puberty, you have this growth plate right here. And we have a couple examples of a mature bone in lab, which is a femur that's been cut in half. And you can see all these different areas, including this epiphyseal line. Okay, now, as you're growing, say at this stage right here, what is stronger? Is bone stronger or is this cartilage stronger? The bone is stronger, right? So this cartilage can be damaged by axial compression. If we were to take a bone that's growing, okay, and compress it from epiphysis to epiphysis, we call that axial compression. It can compress these epiphyseal plates, and it can damage the ossification centers. And when this epiphyseal plate gets damaged, what happens to bone growth? It can grow in diameter, but it can no longer grow in length as a result of that. So what's going to happen if somebody hurts one limb but not the other? One appendage is going to be longer than the one on the other side of the body when that happens. And fortunately, it doesn't happen too much, but maybe it happens a little bit to all of us. Surprised it didn't happen to me a lot, because when I was a kid, I liked to swing on a swing set, get really high, and then what? And then jump off. And that's really fun because you can fly through the air, right? Which is really fun, except for what? The landing is always tough. And so when you land, what do? Axial compression that squishes these growth plates right here, and they can become damaged, and then someone might end up with one bone on one side of their body longer than the corresponding bone on the other side. All right, but that's compression. How else, what other kinds of stresses does a bone have to resist? Not just compression, but also torsion, twisting, okay? And especially males in our society sometimes like to twist the bones in their forearm and their humerus. If they're a little league baseball player, okay, and that is by throwing, especially pitchers. All right, so when you're in little league baseball, you're told to pitch just fastballs, which is you take a ball and you throw it just straight like that. If you throw it straight, guess what? There's no twisting. But to throw really fancy pitches that curve through the air, you have to put spin on the ball. So what do you have to do with your arm in order to put spin on the ball? You've got to twist all those bones and put a lot of twisting or torsion on these bones. And so youngsters before puberty are told never to throw curveballs or screwballs, sliders, things like that, because it can damage this epiphyseal plate and then be really terrible, right? Then their strong arm will be stunted in growth as a result of that. Okay. I see some people smiling up there. Did that happen to you? No? I hope not. Okay, so don't forget, this is not only an epiphyseal plate, but in terms of function, what do you want to call it? The growth plate. It's a growth plate, right? So that's important. And that's an important center for what kind of ossification? Endochondrial ossification, because it's not a membrane. It actually looks like cartilage, all right? Just like what we saw on one of the very first slides of the lecture, what cartilage looks like. You should have a little picture in your mind what cartilage looks like. Okay, and this cartilage ossifies, its activity goes away. These cells are converted to osteocytes right at puberty. And that kind of also explains why, at least within a family, females are shorter than males. Because who reaches puberty at an earlier age, males or females? Yeah, females do, right? And when that happens, these growth plates ossify, and males' long bones will grow for an additional year or two, and so typically they're a little bit taller, at least within a family. Not across the board, but that explains that to some degree. Okay. Appositional growth. Okay, is growth of bone by addition to existing bone surfaces. So when an osteoblast works, say, right on the cortical bone right here, we call that appositional bone growth, as opposed to bone growth maybe in a new growth center, like in a secondary growth center right here. Appositional bone growth also has a connotation of not only adding bone to the superficial surface on the diaphysis, but also removing bone from the medullary surface of the bone. Okay, so you have one part of the bone that's adding, you have another part, the deeper part, that's actually taking bone away to make this medullary cavity. All right, so bone remodeling is happening all the time, but it is accelerated when you damage a bone through a fracture. So when you fracture bone, oh, I might have a picture of this process, maybe. Do I have a picture? I think I don't have a picture. All right, so I'll just describe it to you. All right, so when a bone is fractured, you have a bunch of bone fragments that are sharp, and they're in places that they don't belong. They could be next to a nerve or an artery, in which case they could, sever an artery or sever that nerve. So what would you want to do with that sharp bone fragment? Get rid of it. What would you use, what would you employ to get rid of that bone fragment? A certain kind of cell. An osteoclast, right? We'll get to that bone fragment and dissolve it away, which is pretty nice. So it will dissolve it down into calcium and phosphate, which are some of the building blocks that an needs to build new bone? An osteoblast, right? So osteoclasts will actually make some of the important materials that an osteoblast needs to make new bone. So osteoclasts will break bone fragments down and remove them. Osteoblasts then move in and begin to deposit new bone. And that process for a fracture might take between 4 to 6 weeks. So it's relatively rapid, right? Okay, so that is pretty important. But don't forget, you're doing that to your bones all the time. You start to exercise a bone, then that osteoblastic activity kind of outweighs the osteoclastic activity, and you add bone density to your bones. So in terms of bone repair from fracture, right, you have broken blood vessels that form a clot. There's fibers in that clot that kind of stabilize all the bone fractures. Okay, and after about 2 to 3 days, a callus is formed. So there are fibroblasts that move into that area of all those bone fractures, all the bony little fragments, and it welds them together with collagen so that they don't move around, and that's what we call a callus. And a bone will heal very nicely as long as the callus is not damaged. So after about 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, something like that, a bone should really never be refractured unless you're a specialist. Maybe if you need to reset it or remove it, okay, in a certain location so that it's going to heal properly, it should be done early in the process of healing, not later. Because once that callus is damaged, the bone might not ever heal properly again as a result. But if it is immobilized by using what? What do people sometimes use for a broken bone? Yeah, like a splint maybe on your finger or a cast, something like that. All right, then the bone is probably going to heal and it's going to rejuvenate itself even stronger than what it was before. Bone will, maybe not necessarily tendons and ligaments, but bone will even be stronger than before. All right, so then after the callus is formed, then osteoblasts enter and deposit new bone matrix, and then in about, 4 weeks to 6 weeks, you have a bone that's really good to go. Now, what do you have to be concerned about maybe within that 6 week period? There's something, you're not using that bone, right, which is good because you want it to heal. You don't want to break that callus that's forming, but there's something else that you're not using if it's casted. Muscle. You can have muscle atrophy. All right, and usually within 6 weeks, the muscle doesn't completely degenerate to nothing, but when you remove that cast, you have to be really careful because those muscles are used to inactivity and you got to build that strength back up in those muscles again. Okay, so what's the best way to preserve your body? Diet and exercise. We're going to see that in all different systems of the body. Okay, the proper kind of exercise and proper kind of diet. All right, so that's the initial kind of chapter for bones. And you got some really good exam figures in this chapter, like an osteon is a good exam figure. Maybe fontanelles, if they're in this chapter, they might actually be in the next chapter. And long bone. Oh, long bone is a typical kind of exam figure. Like, all the pieces of a long bone. And that will help you in lab as well, because you have that example. You have that model of a long bone that's cut in half in lab as well. All right, so who can tell me another name for our spongy bone? Spongy bone is?
Medullary
bone, because it's deep. It's also cancellous or trabecular bone. What kind of bone is compact? Compact is, where do you find it? Deep or superficial? Superficial, so it is cortical bone. Cortical bone or compact bone, people use those interchangeably. Because somebody might have a tumor outside of a bone, maybe really close to the periosteum, and you do some imaging studies and you want to see if that tumor has actually invaded the bone. What layer of the bone is a tumor from the outside going to invade first? The periosteum, and then into the bone would be the cortical layer, right? So you would look at those kinds of things, make sure you have nice clean margins of cortical bone, nice smooth cortical bone. Okay, just like the basement membrane should always be nice and smooth. Shouldn't see things poking from one layer to the next right there. All right. Now, people have had problems with these things. What do we call, I guess I got to go through this slide right here. Okay. What do we call these layers right here that make up an osteon? It's a lamellae, but what kind of lamellae? There's one inside of another, inside of another, inside of another. Those are concentric. They're in your notes, concentric lamellae. And then there are some lamellae which surround the whole bone, right? They go all the way around. They're very superficial. They go all the way around the bone. They're layers all the way around the bone. What do we call those? Those are lamellae as well, but circumferential, because they circumnavigate the whole bone, right? Circumferential versus concentric lamellae. Your book kind of lost track of keeping that terminology straight, but it's in your notes, right? It's in your notes. So you should be able to find that. All right, so does anybody have any questions regarding this introductory lecture to bones? No? Okay. How do you keep them healthy?
Diet
and exercise. I guess I need to hear that a lot. Good. Okay, I'm sure everybody does. All right, so the sign-in sheet is going around, and make sure you sign the sign-in sheet, otherwise you're not here. Okay, thank you. And what color is my light?
Green.
Good.